Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I am Lauren Williams, a consultant with Student Loan Planner, and today I am joined by Megan McGuire, a fellow consultant. Megan, how's your day going?
It's going good, Lauren. Thanks for asking. I told you earlier, just trying to survive these Georgia allergies. If you've ever been to Georgia in the spring, you know we get coated with pollen, like talking like your car will be yellow.
So
I'm trying to push forward with my allergies today, but I'm feeling good. I'm excited for today. How are you doing?
I am doing wonderful as well. In fact, I'm heading to Georgia pretty soon. We might get together in person. Can you believe
it? Yeah, we should do lunch or dinner or something.
Yes, absolutely. All right. So today we are talking interesting cases, nuances, and a few updates because there are always things happening in the student loan world. So
yeah, feels like every day, right?
Literally every day something interesting is happening. So why don't we start? Have you had any interesting cases lately?
I have. Yeah. So we are kind of in this interesting gray area where the PSLF waiver ended October 31st. The IDR waiver is in effect right now, but they're still not the FAQs, like the technical way that they're implementing the IDR waiver. That hasn't been published quite yet. We just have some information that is on studentaid.gov about the initial announcement and then some changes that they want to make to PSLF starting July 1. We're in this interesting gray period, but I had a case where someone had unfortunately missed the PSLF waiver deadline, October 31st. The only reason why it would have been applicable to them was they didn't realize that they had one really old undergrad loan, and it was only like $47 left on this loan. But, and so he thought it was paid off. He thought it was already gone. Somehow it wasn't. Maybe there was like a small interest charge that didn't end up getting paid off previously. So a couple things happened with this case. He was pursuing PSLF, but had made some extra payments towards the loans in the past. Initially, maybe not thinking PSLF was going to be the permanent plan. And so maybe trying to hedge bets on, okay, well, if I don't do PSLF, maybe I'll knock out some of my higher interest loans. And then recently decided, hey, I'm pretty darn close to getting to PSLF. I'm within 3 or 4 years. So I think I'm going to go that path. He had thankfully made a lot of payments over the COVID forbearance. So he was able to get those payments back as a refund. He just had to call the servicer and ask. He was with FedLoan previously, got moved over to Mohela with that transition. So his refund has been taking a long time, unfortunately, but it should still be on the way. And the big question, though, for this consultation was, should I consolidate still? Because that one $47 undergrad loan had about 11 months more of PSLF credit. Because before they went to med school, there was some time that they spent working in a public service capacity, about 11 months worth. It was already actually confirmed. Like he already submitted an employment certification for it. We could tell that one loan had 11 months more towards PSLF. So the big question was, is it worth it to consolidate to try to get a little closer to forgiveness? And like I mentioned, we're in this gray period where up until the PSLF deadline, October 31st, we knew for a fact that if you consolidated, the payment count would be rounded up to the highest payment count that any one of those loans had. Now, currently, recording this in April of 2023, we're under the IDR waiver where the language says that if you consolidate now, your payment history will not be erased, but it doesn't have any language on what happens if you have loans with different payment counts. There's not that language out. But in starting July 1, 2023, we know that if you consolidate, they're going to take the weighted average of your credit history between the loans. Best case scenario during this gray out period, you get the highest payment count, kind of like the PSLF waiver. I think worst case scenario, you get the weighted average because that's what is coming up, you know, July 1 anyways. I don't think it's going to reset to zero because the IDR waiver says it's not going to reset to zero. We just don't know exactly what happens if you have different payment counts. So that was kind of the we're between that like rock and hard place where we're like, huh, okay, well, we're not sure, but let's go off of worst case scenario. Does it make sense for us to consolidate if we get the weighted average? Weighted average is not average. Weighted average calculates your average based on the values of those underlying loans. And that $47 undergrad loan was, I think when we did the math, it was 0.2% of his balance. So although it had a higher payment count, it was barely going to affect the weighted average because the rest of his loans had, you know, 11 payments less. They were going to have more of that like oomph bringing to the table for the average. So we ultimately decided, no, doesn't make sense because it worst case scenario, it's not going to change your payment. And if you update your income now, it's going to make your payment $1,000 more than it would have been, you know, when payments restart. So we just decided, nope, we'll take the loss. You know, it stinks that we missed on that guaranteed period that ended October 31st, where we would have known if it was the highest payment count, but it's just not worth the risk to consolidate to potentially just get the weighted average. And so that was a tricky one, but I think we felt great leaving that conversation, knowing what we needed to do. And so, but any ways you want to poke holes in that?
Well, I just think that it was an interesting case. You said there was tons of nuance in the sense that like there's these rules from 1031. There's this gray area right now. Like, it's like, how could they not give us the same payment? Like, it's like no one is knowing what's going on. Like, no FAQs are out. Like, I really want to find a person from Department of Education that will come on this podcast and like straighten it out for us. Yeah. Like, why are there no FAQs? To your point, they're updating this website constantly. There was a big thing recently where we talked about like they changed the consolidation date to December and then they changed it back to May. I actually had a consult recently where somebody was saying, well, which date is it? And it's like, well, the website just says, you know, because all we can go off of is the information that we've been given, but it's like, there's so many things that they left out and they not really thought about. And then you're like, whose idea was it to do weighted average as of July 1st? Like, what? Where's the reasoning behind that? Like, how does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's better than zero though. So I think that's a small win where like, you know, in the future, if people consolidate, they're not going to have a rude awakening when their payment count is now zero. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's a step in the right direction. But yeah, that's a great question. Like, is the weighted average the best way to do that? I don't know.
Right. And who's doing that math? Is it a computer?
Like, because it took me like,
if it's the same people that have right, been doing the, when you call in that 1-800 number, I'm like, I'm not optimistic in their ability to do that math on a regular basis.
Yeah. My gosh. If anyone from Department of Ed or studentaid.gov, if you guys are lurkers on this podcast, we would love to have you. We'll give you a voice. What is it? One of those like voice disguisers. You don't have to tell us your name. You could black out your camera on the podcast screen. We don't have to know who you are, but we would love to talk to you. Please reach out.
100%. And as we think about the website, I was just talking about the website changing constantly. One of the changes for the better has been related to Parent Plus loans. So I had a fun case recently where a gentleman came, he had about $72,000 of student loan debt, $22,000 of Parent Plus loans, about $24,000 for his daughter, and then another $30,000 for his son. So it's actually three separate loans. A parent had decided to be responsible for it, but there's no way to bring it all under one umbrella. You know, the daughter's loans are going to be her responsibility, the son's loans are going to be his responsibility, and then the dad's Parent Plus loans. We started to work through this and I was like, gosh, this is going to be a bad, you know, all I got for this guy is like pay these loans back because the son, like I said, 30K of loans had over $100,000 of income. So not going to warrant any forgiveness. And I had already been on the standard plan for a bit. But as I dug a little bit deeper, I learned that he has been working at a PSLF qualified job since 2017. And so it was like, ah, okay, this is something, and is currently working in a PSLF job and planning to continue there. So it was like, this is something that could work. The reason that it can work is like his income's really high. He's on a standard repayment plan, which qualifies for public service loan forgiveness. But the 3 years of COVID, a non-payment would then warrant him getting some forgiveness when that 10-year time period is up. It makes sense that when payments finally do pick back up, he'll stay on the standard and then there will be some forgiveness as per PSLF. with daughter, income is high enough that there's not going to warrant any forgiveness. And so they do just need to pay him back. But the interest rates are pretty good. So, you know, he was asking about, should I refinance or not? I was like, doesn't really make sense to refinance in this climate. It's going to be hard to find an interest rate as good as the one that she currently has. He has some budget things that he's working on. So it's like, maybe you could go on a graduated or extended plan for a short period. But ultimately, you like, as soon as your budget allows, get these kind of off your plate. And then last but not least, to the point of that website, what's going on with the website, mm-hmm. the Parent Plus loans. And I was like I said, his income is way too high. He does a job. And I was like, God, he's had a PSLF job for 36 mm-hmm. years. Small balance, big income, no forgiveness, except that as per the IDR waiver, and I want to read this language because this is something much different than what was going on during the PSLF waiver. It says that these changes affects on public service loan applicants. These changes will be applied automatically to all PSLF eligible direct loans, including consolidated and unconsolidated Parent Plus loans. So Megan knows why I'm putting emphasis on these words, because even before all these waivers came up, unconsolidated Parent Plus loans did not qualify for PSLF. You had to consolidate them to become eligible for PSLF. So now it's like, hey, open season, everybody, come on over. You're going to get PSLF if you were a qualified employer. So mm-hmm. it says, if you believe you might benefit, update your employer certification to reflect this, and we should be rocking and rolling. So I believe this gentleman is going to get his loan, his Parent Plus loan, fully forgiven based on this language.
Mm-hmm. What's so interesting, and I'll kind of break this down a bit for our Parent Plus folks. So Parent Plus loans, as we know, and as we talk about a lot, you guys are usually left out of so much. Like, we're left out of a lot of the income-driven plans. We're left out of a lot of the future things that are being, you know, that might be coming out, like the new repay plan. This was interesting because the PSLF waiver that expired October 31st specifically said that if you had Parent Plus loans that were unconsolidated, that to get the PSLF waiver credit, you had to consolidate the loans, and they would start at a zero payment count towards PSLF. And that was more just saying like, hey, you're not really part of this PSLF waiver, but to get on track, go ahead and consolidate. And so, you know, a lot of the conversations we had last year and the year before with the PSLF waiver was, hey, you know, you guys have Parent Plus loans. And unless you had another loan from your own education somewhere, which we did a whole podcast episode on that and a YouTube video on that, because that was an interesting find. But if you just had Parent Plus loans, then you wouldn't have had any payment history. That was specifically said in the PSLF waiver. Fast forward to now, the IDR waiver, it is almost like the IDR waiver is coming in and giving us second chances at the second chance of the PSLF waiver in a weird way, because it does specifically say that unconsolidated Parent Plus loans can submit documentation for employment, full-time employment in public service, and get credit on those loans. It seems to say that if you're consolidating still, because maybe we want to get on a lower income-driven plan in the future, that the prior credit on those unconsolidated Parent Plus loans, while maybe they didn't count for the PSLF waiver, they can count for the IDR waiver. That's a very interesting development. So all that to say, if you are someone who has had direct Parent Plus loans and you have been working in public service, you thought maybe PSLF wasn't relevant to you because of what we've learned and knew about the PSLF waiver, now, I think we want to suggest go ahead and submit an employment certification form for that prior employment. And I think it's possible that you could get a payment count update to count those prior years. So that could be a big deal for folks that thought, you know, maybe I'll just pay these off instead, or maybe PSLF isn't going to work because I've got another 10 years to go after consolidating now. So when in doubt, right, I think this is the premise for anything, like anything with PSLF, when in doubt, submit an employment certification form for that employer and just see, have them tell us if it's going to give you payment credits or not. I mean, I have an interesting point on the PSLF help tool here in a bit, but do we want to round out our interesting cases before we get into our updates and nuances?
Actually, let's just go and jump to that, and then we can jump back to some other places. So yeah, since we're on PSLF, let's talk it a little bit more.
So we're going to get into another really big, exciting update with the PSLF help tool. So, you know, based on prior podcasts, I have hot and buttons when it comes to this PSLF help tool, because it's very helpful with like the name. It can be very helpful, but it has gotten even more helpful as of the past like couple days. Like, we literally just found this out a couple days ago when I was on a call with a client. I was just walking them through how to do the PSLF help tool, and all of a sudden it starts asking for them to e-sign that like their portion of the employment certification form. And that just means checking a box saying that, yep, this language is complete to my knowledge. And then it asks for the email to send it to for the employer. And I was like, what is this? What is this, guys? Because you used to have to print. So it was a very, it was still helpful because, like we talked about in prior episodes, the help tool put the form exactly how Mohila wanted to see it in the right format. So it was processed a lot faster than if you were manually completing it. But you did still have to print the form, which also, like, people, when I talked about this help tool in the past, it was kind of funny because I'd talk about it, I'd stress the importance of it, and I'd always get something like, oh, I still have to print it and I still have to take it to my employer. Like, I thought it would be digital. I'm like, yeah, that would make sense. But when does stuff make sense in the federal system?
Oh, my goodness. The number of times that I got, like you said, that like, what? Mm-hmm. Hold on. And I had to like really reiterate, like, yes, I want you to do this online process, but it's not fully online. And it resonates for me. Like, I empathize because I don't own a printer. I run a virtual company. Like, why are we still... Who has a printer anymore? Those people should be out of business. Like, what?
I know. And that's what I would ask is, do you have access to a printer? If not, maybe try to print it at work. Go to your neighbor's house. Like, it was kind of like annoying. But now I'm like on this call, like, oh my gosh, can I screenshot your page? I really need to show this to the team. And so all that to say is now the PSLF help tool is, it can be completely digital. You could still choose to print the form, but now it's completely digital where you can electronically sign yourself. And as long as you have the email for who you need to send it to at work for their signature, that's usually someone in HR, or it can be your direct supervisor, really just anyone who can verify your employment dates. And they're not verifying your income. They're not really looking at anything else. They're just verifying, you know, do you work there? One, and are you working there full time? That's what they're signing off on. So now you can send it electronically and track the progress. Like, you'll see this little like timeline after you send it, and you'll see that it's been sent and it's been delivered. And then you'll see when they sign it and that it's going through processing. So I thought this was such an awesome update. Thank goodness, right?
Amen.
So excited for this.
Like, it is a huge deal for us.
Yeah.
Just way more efficient. Like you said, it makes sense. It's what we should have been doing all along. And we're really grateful to you, Department of Education, for updating your softwares and using technology wisely.
And I think this is what they were doing. There was about a week ago, the website was down. I think we saw that like in our Slack channel from all the consultants. Mm-hmm. They were like, no one can download their text file. I think this is why. I think they were updating the PSLF help tool. That would make a lot of sense. So if you are someone pursuing PSLF, if you've already submitted an employment certification form recently, no need to really go and do this right now, but just know that next time you update your employment, it's going to be a lot easier. So, woohoo.
Yeah. All right. I also had just a fun case the other day. It wasn't necessarily like an interesting, it was interesting in the sense that, you know, it makes you feel really happy about your work. Mm-hmm. So I want to give a shout out to my buddy Cameron, who is an avid listener of the podcast. He had come ready with a set of notes and questions, and he had pretty much like already built his own student loan plan because he's been listening all through mm-hmm. school.
Oh, that's awesome.
So he's like, I found the podcast. It was so good. You know, it even got to a point where he talked about, he did a presentation for his classmates based on the information that he's learned from the podcast.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm like, How cool is that? Like, sharing is caring. Absolutely. Please do take the information that we're providing to you all and put it to good use. You know, spread the good news of student loans, because you'd be surprised the number of people that you can help, mm-hmm. because everybody's living life differently. Everybody has different experiences. And yeah, not everybody knows about this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was just really cool to hear that he is really implementing the things that we're sharing and had done a really good job. And was like, I just need to get clarity on these things. And I had always planned as soon as I got out of school to book a consultation, because you guys are the expert and I don't really know this, this, and this. But, and his plan was like pretty foolproof. So I was like, go, Cameron,
that's
go.
That's awesome. Aw. And so he was just getting kind of the final check of approval. Like, yep, this is what I should be doing. And he could feel confident going forward with it too now. So that's amazing.
Exactly.
Thanks for helping out your classmates.
The nuances are just, like you said, the thing that's so hard to follow. And it was like a few things that he missed out on. So mm-hmm. definitely provide a value in that regard. But it was just so cool to see, like, hey, I believe in what you guys are doing, and I'm actually over here implementing mm-hmm. it.
That's amazing. Aw. Thanks, Cameron. All right. Next on kind of our interesting consultations lately, proportional rules. Do you want to start talking about the double debt loophole, the proportionate payments with repay when both spouses have debt? Do you want to get into that?
Yeah, so I can share a little bit about a case I had.
You're like, okay, this is a doozy.
It is a doozy. So look, get your headphones cleared, you know, turn it up a little bit.
Yeah, and start with telling people like who this could be applicable to, like who might this even be relevant to.
It is relevant. So community property states where income is different. It's relevant if you have two big loan balances that are, well, not two big loan
between
balances.
Between spouses.
Two loan balances. Exactly. Two spouses, right? Two balance student loan balances between spouses that are drastically different. And then also if there are two incomes that are completely different. So mm-hmm. I'll give you a little bit of this case that I had recently and why it's going to be cool for them. So the spouse earns, you know, about $250,000, has about $450,000 of student loan debt. Spouse number one, I'll say. Spouse number two is not working, is currently staying at home with their children and not earning at all, and has about $80,000 of student loan debt. Well, spouse number two also is going to have about 17 years of credit as per the IDR waiver. So in general, it seemed like spouse number two was, you know, they had a plan in the past, and it was going to be to for spouse number two to just pay their loans off. But now with the new IDR waiver, it's going to make sense for them to pursue forgiveness. And also, like I said, spouse number two is no longer working. So what we can do is married filing separately in a community property state. So there are 9 community property states. They live in one of them. And that will split their income. So the, what was I said, 250 of income, it turns into 125 for each person. So why is that good? Because spouse number one is going to have a much lower payment based on $125,000 of income instead of the actual 250 that they earn. Spouse number two, now you're like, wait a minute, they only had $80,000 of student loan debt, Lauren, and now they got to pay based on $125,000? Like, that doesn't sound fun. No, they're not going to have to pay based on the $125,000. They would pay based on the fact they would submit alternative documentation saying, hey, I don't actually make $125,000. I only, you know, I stay at home. I don't make anything. And so that would adjust their payment. But then also, like you said, there's this proportional piece of the puzzle where it's based on your income versus the proportional amount of total
balance
income, right?
Yeah.
The total balance of the student loan. So that is the kind of preface, and I'll let you jump in a little bit more and start digging into the weeds.
Yeah. And this could or could not be a double debt case technically, because we have the community property state in play, which that's a lot of this is almost like two different loophole situations, three if you're counting like filing separate being kind of a loophole, which that's more of a strategy. Yeah. So the big benefit to the breadwinner is that much lower payment, because they're filing separately in a community property state. It chops their income in half because their spouse isn't working. Their tax return is only showing half of their income. They can be on a plan that keeps the payment off of just their own income if they're filing separately. So that would be pay as you earn, IBR or ICR. Were they eligible for pay? Did they
Okay. Yes, I left out a key piece of the puzzle, right? So one spouse is eligible for pay and the other one is not. Yeah. Spouse number one is pay eligible and then the second one.
Mm-hmm. So that's good. So yeah, pay is one of the cheapest income driven plans based on 10% of discretionary income. You're eligible for it if you borrowed after October 1st, 2007. You couldn't have had any loans before then. So that's great. So the breadwinner spouse is, you know, maximizing the income-driven forgiveness path by keeping his payment as low as possible. Spouse two, who's not working now, could also benefit from the community property state in a way. So it at first doesn't seem like it because their tax return is now going to look like they make income. Now, what happens is when they apply for the income-driven plan, it's the tax return is still going to be used. The application is still going to link back to the tax return, which that might scare folks at first when they're doing it. They're like, hang on a second. This isn't going to show my income.
But you said, right.
But you said they're not going to take my taxes. So it's still going to link back to it, which is fine because we need the system to see that you guys filed separately. Or else when you submit alternative documentation of income, they're going to ask for both of your pay stubs, which, or like both of your income situations. So we'd like them to see that you filed separately. The application will still link back to the tax return. It'll see the separate status. But then the next question as it pulls it through to the application is, has your income decreased since that tax return? And you could honestly say yes, because that tax return is not reflective of your income. In this case, this spouse too isn't making any income. So they could say, honestly, yes, my income is not what's reflected on that tax return. And then it'll ask if they have taxable income, which they can honestly say, no, they don't have taxable income. And that makes the payment generate to be zero. So in this case, that way they're both maximizing their options there. Spouse two, though, at this time, with how repay works, would not want to be applying for repay because repay always includes spousal income, regardless of how you file taxes and regardless of how you submit alternative documentation. If you're applying for repay, they're always going to ask for your spouse's income. So we wouldn't want to apply for repay for the spouse. We'd also want to apply for a plan that excludes spousal income if you're filing separately and they don't have access to pay as you earn because they've had loans for 17 years. That's past 2007, right? Oh my gosh, did I do my math right? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, because we're in 2023. So we definitely had borrowed loans before 2007. So they don't have access to pay. The next best option is IBR, income-based repayment. So their payment could be zero, carrying them through to the forgiveness timeline at 25 years. So that's an exciting case where it's kind of a double debt loophole in a sense that we're kind of utilizing two different repayment plans. We're utilizing filing taxes separately. We're taking advantage of the community property state situation, but both of them have a slightly different plan itself. Like they don't have to be on the same income driven plan, if that makes sense.
Right. And I think that kind of the key piece of the puzzle is the proportional part of it is, like you said, revised pay as you earn is going to be proportional based on, like you said, the whole income of the family. Mm-hmm. Whereas with IBR, it's going to be based on your income versus like, yeah, if you had, maybe you can explain, like, if you had a, like I said, one person does, they have $450,000 loan, the other person has $80,000. Like, if it was just a $1,000 payment and everybody was married filing jointly, how would the payment be divided in a normal situation versus situation?
Yeah. No, that's a great question, because this is maybe the trueness of the double debt loophole where we're utilizing repay for one of the spouses. And, you know, we maybe do the same thing for spouse one, where we use the community property, split the income so we have a lower payment, get on pay to keep the payment off of just their own income. But let's say spouse two worked and they did have significant income, but they have a much lower balance. If they were to go on IBR, their payment might be pretty high because the payment would still be based off of their income or the household split of income. So where we strategically use this or this double debt loophole is we consider what repay's proportionate payment would be. Because currently, right now, repay always includes spousal income as part of the payment equation. But let's just use that $1,000, like you said, as a clean example. Let's say the household payment on repay would have been $1,000. If spouse two has $80,000 compared to, was it $250, I believe?
$450. But yeah, let's just say 90%.
Let's make it easy. So let's say, spouse two has 10% of the household debt. Then they're going to have 10% of that repay payment. That's a really low payment potentially compared to how the separate payment would look if it was actually based off of income, if spouse two did have income. So that's, again, getting into the nuances of things, but that could be a way that we utilize repay when, you know, spouses have either, I think where it boils down, where it can become beneficial is when both spouses have either a really large balance and very different income, or the reverse. They have very different balances and maybe similar income. That's where this double debt loophole utilizing repay could be beneficial. Now, we talked a lot about this, like a couple minutes on this topic. I do want to say that if the new repay plan comes out, this may not work the same way because the new repay won't really be proportionalizing the payment anymore unless you're filing taxes jointly. So maybe in the future, we're considering filing jointly and being on different income-driven plans versus separately. But I don't know. We've got some number crunching to do if this new repay plan comes out because it'll just change the way repay works since it allows for filing separately based on how it was proposed.
That means we're going to have another podcast episode that's referred to as Interesting Cases, Nuances, and Updates.
We've got great job stability, great podcast episode stability.
Right. Thank you, Department of Education. All right, let's jump into some of these other like miscellaneous updates that we've kind of bumped into recently. Mm-hmm. So one of the other ones I've seen recently is that you can get a refund. If you made payments on your loans since March 13th of 2020, you are eligible for a refund. But there's always a little you know, if you consolidated your loans, it's now considered a new loan. So that is one instance where you're not going to be able to get a refund. A lot of people just heard the March 13th and they were like, yeah, I did, but there's also been a lot of changes that have been happening. So you need to first request your refund on what you've paid. If you need to consolidate, get your refund back and then consolidate your loans. Yeah. Because once it's been consolidated, it's like, hey, this is a new loan and, we're starting fresh going forward. Yeah. So
to reiterate, if you had made payments on your unconsolidated balance between March of 2020 and, end of 2021, but then end of 2021, you went and consolidated your balance, maybe for the PSLF waiver, maybe for the IDR waiver, what have you. Your payments that you made prior to that consolidation, we don't believe that they could be eligible for the refund. That's what we've been seeing clients get told by their servicers. They can get refunds for payments made after the consolidation, but not before. And then also, this still is true, but FFEL loans, if you consolidated FFEL loans that were commercially held into a direct consolidation loan, you unfortunately can't get a refund for any payments you made on those commercially held FFEL loans. Those were loans that weren't part of the COVID forbearance. That's why you can't get a refund, because they weren't part of what was already paused. But federal direct loans, you can. And if you consolidate, just make sure you ask for a refund of payments before you get that consolidation done.
Amen. Hallelujah. That's going to save somebody some money. So
yeah,
I'm excited for that person that is just hearing this for the first time, because like you said, there are, I think, 360 million people in America now at this point. Mm-hmm. And while it sounds like we might have said that before, there is somebody who didn't hear it. So we kind of talked about the idea about the 3-year credit that's going to be relevant based on that one case I was telling you about. I just want to drive that point too, because where we first discovered it was like, we were thinking about Parent Plus borrowers who have, you know, not had a lot of benefits in the past, but, you know, they've been on maybe the standard 10-year and now they're getting this 3 years of COVID forbearance. And for anybody who's been on a standard plan, you know, just kind of paying away, if you stopped paying during COVID, then you still got this payment count period that is counting toward it. So it's like, oh, this 3 years for so many people is going to help them because you pick up where you left off. So your income is the same, or you don't qualify for income-driven repayment plan. And so you were just going to pay them off and PSLF was not going to be something that's helpful. This 3 years now allows you to be able to get some credit toward PSLF, which makes it now beneficial because that's money that's going to be back in your pocket.
Mm-hmm. So the standard 10-year, and let's back up and maybe actually say that technically the standard 10-year plan does qualify for PSLF for anybody, Parent Plus loans included. The standard 10-year plan qualifies. Why would you not want to be on the standard 10-year plan, though, if you're pursuing PSLF in a normal environment?
It's 10 years.
Well, it's designed to pay the loans off. Yeah, it's designed to pay them off in 10 years. But we're in a unique time frame where we had, so far, 3 years, more than 3 years now of no payments required. So that's free credit if you've been working full time in public service during this time that you get towards PSLF, where maybe, like you said, maybe the income driven plan was just going to be too much to pay it all off. Or maybe, I think that's really the big scenario where, like, if you weren't pursuing PSLF because of that fact, because you were going to just pay it off instead based on the math, looking at the income driven plans, now is kind of a time to take a second look at it, because 3 years, almost 3.5 years by the time payments actually kick back in of free credit will mean you're shaving off like 3.5 years of payments that you would have had to make. So PSLF will, in fact, have a forgiven balance if you're still working full time in public service for that 120 payment time frame total. So if you have questions about that, just shoot us an email, help@studentloanplanner.com. But that could save some money for folks that originally thought PSLF wasn't really going to work out because of the math. But these 3 years are really significant with making that more optimal for folks.
There's so many different things that are working on behalf of the borrower. So I hope people are getting excited about it. I hope you're one of the people benefits from some relief options that are out there. You know, we still keep getting questions about the 10-20K forgiveness, and we're holding just like everybody else to see what's going to happen. We are less and less optimistic as the days go by, but that could help so many people. So we're hoping that there are more things that are coming down the pipeline that are going to be able to fit borrowers, help people get a fresh start, and really be able to work on getting financially stable and or financially free. So hopefully you found a lot of these tips and tricks and nuances and interesting cases helpful. And like I said, don't forget that sharing is caring. So if it wasn't relevant to you, it may be relevant to a friend of yours. Don't be afraid to share this episode so that they can see if it is.
All right. Well, yeah, I think this was a great episode. As always, it's fun having these conversations with you, getting into the weeds together and trying to help people save as much money as possible. If this was helpful, share it with a friend, share it with a parent, colleague, whoever. If you need additional help or have questions about student loan topics, check out our website, studentloanplanner.com. We have tons of free blogs on our website about really every topic student loan related, and we have them separated by profession too. And then free calculators if you wanted to do some number crunching, since payments are supposed to be kicking in this year, could be good to get prepared. Thanks for listening in, and I hope you have a great day today.
Take care, everyone.